Mason Avenue of Conversation. My name is Brian Salvatore. Thank you for joining us this week. When we welcome author Matthew Callan onto the podcast. He is an Mason Avenue alum. He wrote Yells for Ourselves, A Story of New York City and the New York Mets at the Dawn of the New Millennium, which is a book about the 99 and 2000 Mets. It's a must-read for any Met fan. So without any further ado, here's our chat with Matthew. I am joined today on Mason Avenue in Conversation by an Mason Avenue alum? I never know when to say alum versus alumnus, but we'll call you both. Matthew Callan, who is the author of Yells for Ourselves, A Story of New York City and the New York Mets at the Dawn of the Millennium, a truly fantastic book that is available right now. So, Matt, thank you for coming on the show. When did you write for Mason Avenue for our listeners?
Thank you for having me. It's great to be back home at Mason Avenue, I guess. I wrote for Mason Avenue from, if I'm remembering correctly, I believe 2010 through 2014, which were some pretty uninspiring years to be covering the Mets in any capacity. I tried to wring as much out of the lean, Jerry Manuel years as I could.
Oh, playa. Is there a player that you sort of identify as like endemic of those Mets teams?
You know, I was literally trying to think about that earlier because I was thinking about when I wrote and like those teams, and it's kind of a blur because they were all kind of miserable. Yeah. If we wanted to be positive, we could say R.A. Dickey.
Sure.
Who was active at that time and, you know, won the Cy Young Award and was immediately flipped for Noah Syndergaard.
And John Buck.
Yes, of course.
Just messing with you, but yes, of course.
Oh, yeah. And I'm trying to think of, like, I was trying to think of somebody, some sort of, like, obscure Met. You know what? Here's a good example. This is probably a somewhat sad example, but Ike Davis is probably an indicative of that period.
Ooh,
where
yeah.
He came up, he was pretty good for a while and mm-hmm. then fell off a cliff. I think just due to, if I'm remembering this correctly, I think he had like
Valley Fever.
Yeah. Valley Fever. I couldn't remember what it was, but just one of those things where like, you know, people say like only the Mets, and a lot of times that's like exaggerating and, you know, people gloss over the fact that, you know, you're always going to look at your own team, you know, as like putting you through hell, you know, more so than other people's teams do. But that was one of those things where it definitely seemed like, has this ever happened to another team where they had a guy who was, you know, looked like he might be, you know, a slugger, and falls prey to, some kind of condition that is not like life threatening, but basically ends his baseball career, you know, and that no one's ever heard of either. So,
yeah, I was trying to think of a player like, you know, who do I think of when I think of those years? And a name that kept coming back to me was Angel Pagan.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
Seems like a guy who was there, who was almost good the whole time, but was never quite good, you know, just very indicative of those teams.
And then wound up being, you know, I don't want to say spare part, but, you know, he had some important contributions to the Giants when they, you know, won a couple of World Series. So, you know, just, you know, he was a decent guy on bad Mets teams and was an okay guy on some good other teams.
And that also seems like the perfect Mets story. It seemed like for a while there, anyone who was just okay with the Mets, we would let walk and then mm-hmm. would become great for somebody else. See Justin Turner, you know, you say Angel Pagan, there's lots of examples of that. But anyway, we're not here to talk about weird Mets from the early teens. We're here to talk about your book. So I know this book is a labor of love for you. It's a long time coming. When did you start this book? And sort of what was the initial impulse to write a book about these Mets years?
Well, I think it was just loving those teams so much. Those teams being the 1999 and 2000 Mets. The 99 team, I think, in particular, has like there's a soft spot in my heart for that team. And I think for a lot of Mets fans who are sort of around my age, which would mean that in 1999, you were probably like, you might have been in high school or in college or just out of college. And that was sort of like your team in a way. It was the first Mets team that had been good in a very long time or had been a playoff contender in a very long time. And, you know, just there was, for me in particular, that team was, you know, I had loved baseball as a kid. I kind of fell away from it, I think, as a lot of people do as they get older. And that was a team that like sucked me back into, you know, loving baseball and loving the Mets again. And so it was sort of like, I feel like a debt to that team to sort of like celebrate it.
You basically described my experience, by the way. I was 17 in 99 and had fallen off for a couple of years. And so that was the team that brought me back as well. So it's really cool to hear you say that.
Yeah, I mean, I think I know that was my very particular experience, but I think it might have been, you know, as you just described, I think it might have been an experience that a lot of people had. I think especially if you were a Mets fan and for much of the 90s, what did you have to cheer for at all except for, you know, Todd Hundley occasionally,
Carlos,
you know,
Baerga.
Like Carlos Baerga, like the very first Subway Series game and then basically none of them after that for a couple of years. Yeah, so I mean, as far as like the origin of the book itself, I used to have a blog, and just because I wanted to celebrate this team. On the blog, I did like literally a day by day look back at the 99 Mets in 2009, sort of celebrating the 10th anniversary of it. And then by the next year, I was writing for Amazing Avenue and did the same thing for 2000, in a little more condensed form. It wasn't exactly a day by day thing, but it was a, you know, pretty close survey of the seasons. And in doing that, sort of recognized how much, you know, the sort of narrative that was woven around those two teams, you know, in the media, and how much it had to do with what was happening in New York City at that particular time, which already 10 years on was like, you know, it seemed like it was a completely different place already. And that was essentially, you know, just in doing that and recognizing that was probably the you know, the biggest impetus for trying to weave it into an actual narrative form that it's in now.
It's I'm glad that you brought up sort of New York City at that time. What I was struck by when reading the book was, because, you know, I grew up in, you know, northern New Jersey, and so was living in this area until I went to college in Pittsburgh in August of 2000. But so most of this book takes place when I was just a few miles from the action, and I had forgotten sort of the events that dovetailed with these teams. Like, for instance, you mentioned the art exhibit at the Brooklyn Museum where somebody had used elephant dung to paint the Virgin Mary, and how that was a really big deal, or something like mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton's run for Senate as a carpetbagger, you know, not from New York, but running for Senate in New York. And mm-hmm. I had forgotten sort of how many of those things were happening at that exact time. And it seemed like a really wild time to be a New Yorker as well as a wild time for the Mets. So I guess my question for you is, when you started researching this, did you remember all of that? That's when it was happening concurrently? Or as you were doing your research and you came upon certain dates and you realized, like, oh shit, that was a week before this happened, you know? I guess, you know, how strong was your memory of those non-baseball events before you started writing the book?
I think it, you know, I certainly remembered certain things better than others on a, you know, chronologically. Mm-hmm. I think probably what happened a lot and what really drove the decision to kind of, you know, weave a lot of stuff about New York City at that time into it was that it was just doing the research, like literally Googling or, you know, just looking up, you know, just trying to find archives of articles about the Mets from that time. It was almost impossible to not find frequently that baseball was getting, you know, swept up in whatever was happening in the city at that particular time. You know, you mentioned the Brooklyn Museum thing, which was like, it was kind of like a big, you know, Rudy Giuliani era thing where he got very upset about an African artist who was displaying, who's going to be part of an exhibit there. They use elephant dung in a painting that was called, I believe it was called the Virgin Mary or something to that effect. And he threatened to cut funding from the museum, and it became a big, obviously a big free speech issue. And I probably wouldn't have even mentioned that in the book at all, except, not to spoil it, but there's a little anecdote in there about, that's, Mets related. And I remember that article kind of coming up in a, you know, in a search, and, there was a source for that anecdote, and just remembering, oh yeah, that happened that year. And just how, you know, just how impossible it was to not, find baseball stuff and Mets stuff in, you know, city politics or, you know, city civic life. And how much, you know, politics and other concerns intruded into baseball. It was like, it worked both ways.
Yeah. It was really a fascinating sort of trip back through that time in the New York metropolitan area, because I think it's easy for us to, you know, sort of in broad strokes, remember, you know, before the Disneyfication of Times Square, or before, you know, Giuliani came in and really cleaned up the streets. But it's really interesting to juxtapose that with events that I remember really well. Like, you know, I definitely remember when those things, I remember noticing that those things had happened or reading about those things happening, but I wasn't thinking about them as happening contemporaneously to these baseball moments, which obviously had such a huge impact on my life. So I really enjoyed that part of the book. I thought it was a really surprising piece of the story that I didn't expect to find in there. So thanks for including that stuff. That was really fun.
Cool. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. And again, like I said, it was almost impossible to not write about that. I think it was important to give, like, at the very least, I think it was important to give sort of a context of what was happening in the city at the time. And, you know, it's sort of parallel. There's, you know, the book goes into it, but it's sort of paralleled, like, what was happening in the city was very much sort of paralleled by what was happening baseball wise in the city, you know, especially with like the Yankees being the sort of monolithic dynasty and the Mets just trying to find some sort of place for themselves in the city that had changed a huge amount between the times that they were last relevant in the 80s and then into the late 90s again.
Yeah, what I always remember about those years as a Mets fan is, you know, when I was growing up, I would say my group of friends was majority leaning Yankees, but even so, there was very little competition between the two teams. Like, I don't think my Yankee fan friends ever gave me a hard time about being a Met fan or vice versa. It was just sort of these two teams somewhat peacefully coexisted in the eyes of at least, you know, the young fan. But around this time is when you really start to see true partisanship between Yankee fans and Mets fans. And there were a couple of years there where I feel like the Yankees were more disliked by Mets fans than the Phillies or the Braves were, which is insane because those teams were playing the Mets all the time and the Yankees rarely did. But it really became this territorial, you know, sort of Warriors-esque existence where there were Mets fans and Yankee fans, and it was very unpleasant for a while between then. In doing your research, did you come across sort of a tipping point from when that sort of rivalry started? Was it right around this time, or was that just, you know, indicative of sort of my age at the time and my personal experience?
I kind of feel the same way that you're, you know, that you're describing from your own experience, that they're really in the 80s, you know, maybe even going back farther than that, there really wasn't the same, I think, level of animosity. I think it was definitely more subdued. I feel like in doing the research for this book, it seems to me like the advent of the regular season Subway series was really the impetus for that. That kind of cranked things up to another level. I remember I actually, I had a thing in the book where that had to cut for space, unfortunately, but there was I had found a lot of articles late in actually 1985 when both the Mets and the Yankees were kind of in the hunt for the playoffs. Mm-hmm. And it seems from the way the coverage was at that time, it seems like things were much more friendly. It seems like people were very excited in a not really antagonistic way about the prospect of a possible Subway series. Now, as it turned out, neither team made the playoffs that year, so it quickly kind of fizzled out. So who knows what would have happened if they had actually come close to that happening. Maybe we would have seen that animosity.
Right.
But then you flash forward 12 years later, 1997, you have the first Subway Series game, and there's a huge amount of animosity among the fans of the teams for each other, especially a lot of animosity. You didn't have to dig too deep. All of the contemporary accounts of that time touch on it, and they try to dismiss it. They always kind of present it, you know, couch it in terms of like it's good natured or it's just fan enthusiasm. But then you would read what people were actually saying, and it seemed like much, much more hostile than just, you know, enthusiasm for your team. It seemed very much like also hatred for the other team.
Yeah.
And so I think, I mean, just contrasting those two, I had hoped to do that in the book. I wish I could have written about that 1985 segment. I had something written, and unfortunately there's a lot of stuff that I had to cut just to get the book into a size that they would actually publish. My original manuscript was probably close to twice as long as the Wow. finished book. And I'm sure a lot of that, you know, if I'm being, you know, perfectly honest, I'm sure a lot of that, you know, is not missed, you know, like it's a thing where, you know, if you less is more probably. But there's a couple of things that I remember, you know, originally having in the book that I wish I could have kept. And I think that was one of them, but I just could not squeeze it in there. I think it sort of serves as to show that there was a time where things weren't quite as antagonistic, and that really that first Subway series was where you see it bubbling up for the first time.
There was a book that was just released a few months ago called Doc Donnie the Kid and Billy Brawl, How the 85 Mets and Yankees Fought for New York's Baseball Soul. It's by a guy named Chris Donnelly. It's fantastic. It's a really good book that looks at that season from the perspective of the two teams, kind of, you know, the Yankees were falling down and the Mets were rising up, and they kind of met in the middle for that season. And I highly recommend it. And they do talk about it's written by a guy named Chris Donnelly, and Chris talks about the sort of perception of just how the Mets were this really fun, really, up and coming team, and the Yankees were kind of this dysfunctional mess. And it's just funny to think of the Yankees as a dysfunctional mess in the era of, like, the Wilpon ownership and, Valley Fever, etc. It's funny to think of the Mets as the team that had their shit together once upon a time.
Yeah, I mean, at that time, and I touch on it a little bit in the book, again, not as extensively as maybe as, I wish I could have gone a little bit more into it. But in the 80s, the Yankees were generally, for most of the 80s anyway, the Yankees were a mess. And the mess was laid right at the feet of George Steinbrenner, which, again, I think might be a little difficult for people to to remember, you know, if you weren't alive then, or you don't, you know, or you're very young, you don't remember it that well. I mean, he was universally loathed, and universally loathed by Yankees fans too. Like, Yankees fans did not like him. They did not like the way that he constantly meddled with the team, and his sort of iron grip on the roster, especially for signing free agents who often wound up being busts. And you know, they were just like, they basically couldn't buy a headline in the 80s next to the Mets, unless it was related to George Steinbrenner doing something, you know, short-sighted, or him blowing up at somebody, or him firing Billy Martin for the 8 millionth time. I mean, you know, it's, again, it's difficult to, if you weren't around then, to sort of remember that, because of what happened in the 90s with the Yankees, where they had their dynasty, and he was a little more hands off at that point. He essentially wiped away the memory of that completely, and now he's kind of sainted again, especially among Yankees fans who tend to remember that, you know, the 90s, early 2000s dynasty, and forget what he was doing in the 80s, which, you know, if I was a Yankees fan, I would probably do that as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey everybody, I'm Neil I. Patel, editor-in-chief of The Verge, and this is The Vergecast. Vergecast is the flagship podcast of The Verge. Every week we cover the latest in tech news and reviews. We take a critical look at what is going on now and next in the world of tech. The show is hosted by me, our executive editor, Dieter Bohn.
Not your friend.
And Paul Miller.
It just feels like there's something wrong with all computers, though. Don't you think that sometimes?
We do that on Fridays, and on Tuesdays we have an interview episode. I've been talking to all kinds of influential people in and around the world of tech. We talked to Microsoft founder Bill Gates about his philanthropic efforts.
You can design systems without having to reveal any individual's particular medical record.
Journalists and academics like Lina Khan, who thinks that we should be doing way more to break up giant companies like Amazon and Facebook.
I think in hindsight, allowing Facebook to buy up both WhatsApp and Instagram proved to have been the wrong call.
And we talked to tech CEOs like Vizio's Bill Baxter, who explained exactly how smart TV manufacturers make their money.
It's about post-purchase monetization of the TV.
It's ads.
It's ads. Check us out every Friday to hear about everything in tech, from new iPhone leaks to breaking down Facebook's ongoing issues of privacy to just me and Paul ranting at each other about the role of the government. And check us out on Tuesdays when I host the interview episode. Subscribe to The Vergecast wherever podcasts are served. We'll see you then.
Hey, I'm Spencer Hall.
I'm Holly Anderson.
I'm Ryan Nanny.
I'm Jason Kirk. And we're the hosts of the Shutdown Fullcast, your Avengers of college football podcast. It says here in the script, I'm to riff on what that means. And basically what I mean is it's all already spoiled.
Every Tuesday, we talk about everything from cooking disasters to pro wrestling to unfashionable pants we wore in middle school.
We also do talk about college football every now and then, like mascot fights, announcers fleeing the booth early, and unfashionable pants that coaches wear now.
If you want to take college football exactly as seriously as it should be taken, subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about a couple of things in the book that just, to me, were so indicative of the era. And the one thing I want to talk about, which is kind of an odd thing to talk about, is who let the dogs out? So this was the Mets, what I perceived as the Mets sort of rallying cry that season. I remember going to games at Shea that summer and hearing that song played and, you know, watching the sort of the playoff push, and that was always the celebratory song at the end of the night. But you blew my mind. Apparently that was the celebratory song for like every team in baseball that year. That seems like something that's, it wasn't pre-internet, but it was pre sort of easy access to everything on the internet. And I wonder how many instances like that would you sort of find if you looked back at, you know, at all of baseball history, of just things happening, you know, kind of organically across baseball. But that's the reason that's interesting to me is that it seems to me like that was the first time that the Mets, I guess you can count the Mojo Rising the year before, which was their sort of winning music the year before. But this was the first time that the Mets had a discernible personality in a while. And there were certain players that definitely fed into that personality. And I think that, you know, the biggest probably relic of that time in terms of the person who just represented all that the Mets were, good and bad, of the era was Bobby Valentine. And so I want to talk about Bobby V a little bit. I think I have a very rose-colored memory of Bobby Valentine as a Mets manager, but reading this book, I was constantly taken aback by how many weird decisions he made and sort of how just oddly he managed at times. How did your perception of Bobby Valentine change from what you remembered versus what you researched?
I think in my memory, I always kind of liked him, you know, while recognizing that he drove a lot of people crazy, including people on his own team and in his front office. I think ultimately, after doing all the research and everything, I think that he is a genuinely talented and skilled and unique baseball mind. And I think he was, in many respects, a good manager, and that he just would undermine himself often by, you know, just being impolitic in various ways and, you know, not being able to basically keep his mouth shut. Like, I can't imagine. I know that he did get another chance at managing the Red Sox years ago that ended pretty disastrously. But I can't imagine somebody like him managing now. I mean, just for the sheer like PR nightmare that it would probably be on a daily basis. Like, that's not how like teams are run now for various reasons. I mean, I think that he was in many ways sort of, but I also think he was also, some of the, like, you know, many of the controversies were of his own making, certainly. But he also kind of wound up being in charge of a Mets team that wasn't always suited to his best, his like best talents. He was very much a guy who, was good at wringing, performances out of younger players. Like, he was a good like teacher of the game, and he could do a lot with, young players or marginal players. And he always clashed with veterans. When he first took over the Mets, I think late in 1996, they were not very good at that point, and they didn't have a lot of veterans, and most of the people on the team were products of their farm system. And then shortly after he became the manager, Steve Phillips became the GM. And Steve Phillips' vision for the team was to do what a lot of teams at that point in the late 90s were doing, which was stock up on pricey veterans as long as you could afford it. And the Mets at that time, believe it or not, could afford it. And so immediately there was sort of like a personality crisis of Bobby Valentine having a team on his hands that wasn't the kind of team that, you know, if given his druthers, he would have led. For instance, I think after the 1997 season, where the only stars that the Mets had that season were really John Olerud and Todd Hundley, who was a pretty big star at that time. Everyone else on the team was kind of like I could probably think of a few exceptions, but it was a pretty sort of like no-name team that did okay that season. They kind of overachieved. And at the end of that season, I think Steve Phillips described them as a good little team with good little players. And it sounds very condescending, and I'm sure he meant it to be condescending, because he had designs on making a team full of stars. And that wasn't suited to like Bobby Valentine's sort of his personality or his talents. So I think it's sort of two-pronged. I think he, you know, you could certainly question a lot of what he did on and off the field during the period, but he also sort of was always waging a little bit of a war with Steve Phillips and to a smaller extent, the ownerships, like that you know, he never had planned on doing.
Yeah. It's amazing. You mentioned before how it will be hard for you to imagine a manager like Bobby Valentine being hired today. I think it's equally hard to imagine Steve Phillips coming to prominence today.
Yeah.
They're both kind of products of their time in a way.
Definitely. I mean, the thing with other than the fact that people don't really build teams in that manner anymore, Steve Phillips also had a number of issues that I sort of touch on in the book that would probably not fly in this era either.
Yes, that's a nice way to put it.
Yeah.
Now, were there any players that, you know, you loved growing up with this team that when you look back on were, you know, maybe less special than you remember them being, or vice versa, a player you sort of always kind of dismissed, but when you look back on it, you thought, oh, that was a really good player. That guy was important to the Mets.
I don't know. Like, as far as the players go, I kind of was at the same place when I ended.
Okay.
You know, I always really loved Edgardo Alfonso. You know, obviously, you know, Mike Piazza was probably the most important person on that team, and it's, you know, the nothing that I found in the course of my research convinced me otherwise. The only example I think I can think of in that regard is maybe Robin Ventura, who I always liked, but I think in doing the research, looking back at it, especially in 99, I think he was so unbelievably important to that team in a way that kind of floats under the radar, in part because of his own personality. He was not he's not a flashy guy, and he wasn't great with the press in the way that some other players were. Like, he wasn't one of those guys who was always going to the press or sort of lobbying for himself as near as I could tell anyway. Sometimes you have to kind of read between the lines, especially if you're reading sort of like beat writer stuff or gamers and stuff, and you see who gets quoted and who doesn't. And he gets quoted a fair amount. So it's not like the reporters didn't seek him out, but there's also plenty of examples of them sort of like trying to get him to toot his own horn and never does. Like, he was very much a self-deprecating person when he was a player, very much a guy who would always like try to say that he was, you know, especially on the infield, you know, thinking about the 1999 Mets and their rep as possibly the greatest infield ever defensively. There's a whole Sports Illustrated article about him, it's ostensibly about the infield, but the article is mostly about him. And most of the article is him trying to deflect praise and trying to praise everybody else on that infield. And it's a very odd thing to read, because it seems like they wanted to profile Robin Ventura, and it's almost like he didn't give them enough to do that, and they kind of had to fall back on like making it about the entire infield. So yeah, I think if I had to pick anybody, it might be him. Even though I did really like him at the time, I think a lot of what he did and what he meant to that team is obscured just by his own refusal to be in the spotlight.
See, for me, a guy that I guess just, you know, the haze of memory had made a more important player than he was Benny Agbayani. You know, he just seemed to me to be a really endemic of the team, and sort of the young players that weren't supposed to be superstars coming up being significant. And he was still very good for that team, but looking back, he was nowhere near the phenomenon that I had sort of built him up to be in my head. And part of that is probably because I was young, and also because, you know, as a 17-year-old, I wasn't watching every game or you know, living and dying with the team the way I do now. I was watching a lot of Mets games, but I had a job and I had homework to do. And, you know, so I think it was easier to get caught up in the sort of big game moments and, you know, not focus on the day to day of a player like Agbayani.
Well, I think specifically for Benny Agbayani, he was actually a sensation when he first came up. Like, I think his first month or so in the bigs in 1999, he was hitting home runs left and right. And then all of a sudden he kind of fell off a cliff, and it was a while again before he hit another home run. And then in the playoffs of that year, he had a couple of moments, but in general, he didn't do a huge amount in the 99 playoffs. So that by the time you got to the spring training of next year, he was in danger of starting the year in the minors, and he didn't want to do that. And it might've led to an ugly situation where he would have demanded a trade. And really, apparently the only thing that saved him was him hitting a grand slam when the Mets were in Japan to open the season that year in 2000. And then also there were a couple of injuries to other guys like Darrell Hamilton and a couple of other players in the outfield. And he just sort of made the roster by the skin of his teeth and wound up having a pretty good year that year. But I think it's sort of maybe a mix of like what you remember and sort of the reality of it, which is like he had these little moments where he was like the man, but he also had a bunch of, and I, for obvious reasons, I think we want to remember that kind of stuff more than we do, you know, the 2 or 3 weeks where somebody goes, you know, 0-for-40 or something.
Right. Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit about the Subway Series of 2000, because I think for a lot of Mets fans of my approximate age, and it sounds like you're approximate as well, that's sort of a defining moment in our fandom. And I think it's really easy to fall into this trap where you armchair quarterback your team and say like, oh, if just, you know, if one or two things had broken this way, we would have won that series. And it's really easy to sort of make up excuses and come up with alternate histories, etc. But reading this book, I was really taken by just how the Mets really would have had a chance if just one or two things broken differently. If Timo Perez had run, things could have been very different. If Bobby Valentine had made more of a stink when Clemens hit Piazza in the head, things could have been very different. It's really amazing to me how many, hit Piazza in the head, I'm sorry, through the bat at Piazza. You know, it's just amazing to me how many little moments really did determine that that series. When you were going back and doing research, was it just immensely painful to be reliving how close the Mets came in some of those moments?
Oh yeah, definitely. And like having to, you know, I watched as many games as I could for, you know, as many as I had available to me while writing the book, and obviously had to rewatch the entire 2000 series a couple of times, and, you know, found games one and of course game five to be particularly painful. Yeah, I mean, I agree with you that it's definitely would have been, if just a couple of things had gone the other way, the Mets absolutely could have won that series. And I talk about it a lot in the book just to give everything context. But for most, maybe it's not fair to say most, but for a lot of the 2000 season, people were, the media and fans were very much in love with the Mets, and they very much thought that they were the more exciting, more fun team, and that the Yankees were old and tired. They ended their season, the Yankees did, on a horrible streak, and basically only won their division because everybody else in the division was just not good. It was either, you know, either had huge injuries or just weren't up to, just kind of ran out of time to try and catch the Yankees. But they ended their season terribly. And it was probably just them taking it easy, because they did have an older team and they probably knew that they had to rest up for the playoffs. And they struggled throughout the first round of their playoffs against the A's. They a little less so in the championship series against the Mariners. But people were constantly writing about the Yankees, you know, it's constantly writing about the end of their dynasty, constantly writing about how old and boring they were. That was the big thing that so many people were writing, that they were basically boring to watch. And I think that, I think a lot of people not only thought that the Mets could overtake them that year, but really wanted them to, and really wanted them to do that as a sort of like a corrective to this like monolithic Yankees team just winning year after year. And when it didn't happen, it was not just depressing if you were necessarily a Mets fan. It was just sort of depressing of the sort of idea of like, well, this just, you know, it just doesn't matter. You know, like things, you know, it's just, well, they're just going to win forever and ever, even when they look like they might be toppled. Like, they just win. That's all that happens. So, yeah, I mean, it was definitely painful to watch a bunch of these games. And, you know, I feel like it would have been better if somehow the Mets had gotten swept and lost like 10-0 in every game. Right, and you would just be like, well, they were just outclassed.
Yeah.
Yeah, the better team, like, they just got clobbered. Like, it was just no, there's just no comparison. But it was just the fact that it was so close, but they still lost, was just made things that much more painful. And I touch on it a little bit in the book, but it kind of parallels to the 2015 team, which another team that lost the World Series in five games, in a series where they could have and should have won like three of the games that they lost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another incredibly painful
net
memory for a lot of us.
I'm Todd Vanderwerf, the host of Primetime, a new show from Vox.com. This season, we're tackling the American presidency on TV. Stories that capture the way television affects and reflects politics and culture. We'll take a look at fictional presidents who've changed the way we think about the real Oval Office.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Good morning, everyone. Please, take your seats.
And how real presidents use TV to further their own goals.
What did you come here to plug?
Have you heard of the Affordable Care Act?
From the first TV president.
People have got to know whether or not their president is a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
To arguably the last.
We are fighting the fake news. It's fake, phony, fake.
Primetime from the Vox Media Podcast Network and Vox.com. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Beyonce, Ariana Grande, and Drake are talked about ad nauseum as celebrities, but there's one thing that's rarely discussed, their music.
On Switched on Pop, we go deep into the sounds of pop music to explain what it means, how it's made, and why it's so effective.
We talk with some of today's greatest artists, producers, and journalists to decode the musical logic behind our modern soundtrack and understand its role in our culture.
Switched on Pop will reveal for you how a secretive Swedish producer is behind many of the top 10 hits of the past 20 years.
And we'll uncover the ways that songwriters embed their political activism into today's most popular tracks.
We'll show you the surprising musical similarities between Cardi B and Taylor Swift.
And we'll even dive into the classical past to hear how the Jonas Brothers mirror Mozart's youthful party days.
I'm songwriter Charlie Harding.
And I'm musicologist Nate Sloan.
Join us on a journey through the world of popular music by subscribing to Switched on Pop on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app to get new episodes every Tuesday.
You know, I don't like playing this kind of game, but I think you, as somebody who's revisited this team, so recently, you just have context that most of our listeners just don't have or haven't had in a very long time, because, you know, not a lot of us have been able to go back and watch a lot of those games, which is, I do want to talk to you about that in just a minute. But, you know, how do you think the next couple of years might have looked for the Mets had they, even if they didn't win the World Series, but if they had just been more competitive in the World Series? Do you think that the Mets would have continued to spend the way they did? Do you think that this was always sort of the end of the arc? You know, again, it's impossible to know, but sort of looking back, what do you think the team would have looked like had they won the World Series, or at least won a couple more games in the World Series?
Well, I think if they had actually won the World Series, that would have been like, just, I think like heads would have exploded all over the place. and then it almost wouldn't have mattered anything. It almost wouldn't have mattered what happened after that. Like, they could have had like 20 losing seasons in a row after that. But if they had beaten the Yankees in the World Series, like, that's a trophy you can hold over your head till the end of time. I think if they've been a little bit more competitive, I don't know if it would have made a huge amount of difference, because, you know, it was not, those teams were not built to last, really. Again, harking back to the Steve Phillips thing of him, you know, having so many veterans on the team, so many guys who were already about to be on the downside of their careers. I talked about Robin Ventura earlier. He had a terrible year in 2000. You know, he had some important contributions throughout the season and throughout the playoffs, but for the most part, he was already beginning his decline, basically. The same was true for a lot of players on that team. I mean, Mike Piazza wouldn't have too many more really great seasons after 2000. You know, he'd have some, but, you know, nothing compared to what he had done up to that point. So I feel like it probably, like, if they had a little better showing in the World Series, probably wouldn't have made much difference in terms of, like, what, you know, like, that it would have meant that they would have had a more sustained success, because to sustain that success, they would have had to keep spending, and they did to a certain extent try to do that. There's, we all know the, like, sort of the ones that got away, like, they didn't make a serious play for Alex Rodriguez or Vladimir Guerrero at that time. They did try and spend money on guys like Mo Vaughn and Roberto Alomar not too long after the 2000 series, and that did not work out well, as I'm sure most people remember. So it's not like they didn't try. They essentially tried to do the same thing they had done that had got them almost to the mountaintop in 2000, and it didn't work out. So, you know, with the same, assuming the same front office and the same philosophy in place, I'm honestly not sure that it would have made much of a difference.
Now, I want to talk a bit about the research you did for this book. You mentioned before that you watched as many games as you could to sort of bone up on, you know, what happened during the average game during the season. But Major League Baseball makes it very, very hard for fans to do that. And so I'm not going to ask you to betray your sources of games or anything like that. But do you have any sort of, I don't want to say insight, because that's the wrong word, but what do you think fans would gain if it was easier for us all to go back and watch games from that season? Do you think that there's a market for that outside of, you know, the diehards like the two of us? Do you think that people would learn more about the game? Would we be better students of the game? You know, just sort of how would things be different if everybody could have access to, you know, 50, let's say, games from these seasons?
I mean, I think there would be, I'd like to think that there would be lots of people would be interested in something like that. And I think that, I mean, the thing that I always find fascinating when you go back and you watch just a full game from, and, you know, really from any era, that you get such a picture of what's the same, what's changed. You know, so many things, so many times watching games from these two seasons and just thinking to myself, oh, well, that wouldn't be a strike now, or, you know, well, they would call that as a check swing you know, nowadays, but they didn't back then. Or you see the way that people approach at bats is different. You know, there's so many little things that you would notice in the, I think, in sort of the way that the game is played or the way that players approach the game that gives you, you know, gives you a real snapshot of the era. Even just to hear the announcers, the way they talk about the game, it's very different. You know, you wouldn't hear people talking about pitch counts. And that's not to say that that's a good or a bad thing, but it's a thing that you would notice for sure. That you just sort of be a reminder of like, oh yeah, like they used to not talk about pitch counts all the time. I mean, I would love to see that. Anytime I see like an old game on YouTube, and it's actually gotten a lot. I've noticed the last couple of years has actually gotten a little easier. If you go on YouTube, there's a lot of just random regular season baseball games on YouTube. They're just there. I guess MLB is not as maybe as litigious or you know, enforcing that kind of thing as much as they used to. So I think that you know, there are some resources out there. It's very random, of course. Like you can find, you know, maybe two games from one season, another game from another season. It's kind of all over the place. So there's no way that you could like piece together just on YouTube like a full portrait of an entire, you know, team's season. But there is a lot of good stuff out there right now, you know, knock on wood, that, you know, people can find and take a peek at. But yeah, I would love to see something where baseball just offered something like that. I don't know that they even could. I think my impression is that baseball doesn't have a lot of full broadcasts of things. I think they have a lot of them, but they certainly don't have like every game, you know, going back 50 years or whatever. I mean, so it's probably a case where baseball literally doesn't have a lot of stuff. They'll have like highlights and so forth, but they don't have like the full game. And so that might be a factor into why they don't offer something like that.
Mm-hmm. How many games do you estimate you watched from these two seasons while writing the book?
Well, every playoff game for sure. I probably watched, that's a good question. I nowhere near a full season, of course, cause I was only able to get my hands on, a relatively small amount of games. I would say at least, I would say at least 20 or 30 games per regular season games for each of the seasons. And then there's also a good number of radio broadcasts that you can find out there. And I've some of which overlap with the games, overlap with the games that I was able to watch, some of which don't. For instance, I wasn't able to find an actual TV broadcast. There was a game in 1999 where Edgardo Alfonso went 6-for-6 at the Astrodome and had like just a game for the ages. And I really wanted to find, I just wanted to watch it. Cause again, as I said earlier, he was one of my favorite players. I could not find that game. Could not find video of that game, but I was able to find a radio broadcast of it, of, you know, Gary Cohen and Bob Murphy calling the game, which was pretty cool. Yeah. So it was, you know, it was close enough.
Yeah. Do you think that, there are any real parallels between the 99-2000 Mets and the 2019 Mets that we're watching play right now?
They're very, I think they're very different in sort of their strengths. Like I think the current Mets, obviously their biggest strength should be starting pitching. It's been a little spotty so far in the season at times, but it seems like maybe it might be rounding into shape. The 99 and 2000 Mets did not have great starting pitching. They had Al Leiter, who could be pretty good, and then the rest of their staff was kind of like soft tossing guys. And their pitching was made better by the aforementioned infield, which, you know, basically vacuumed up anything that was hit their way. They had a lot of contact pitchers, and that infield made sure that they, you know, that all of those ground balls got turned into outs, which is something that you do not see on the current Mets. They're probably similar in somewhat in lineup wise, although I could think the current Mets are a little more on the left hand side than they did, those teams did. You know, it's hard to say that they are kind of very different. The current Mets team has a lot more younger guys on it. I think, you know, probably Cano is probably, or maybe Todd Frazier, about it for like sort of the veterans of the lineup. Whereas the 99/2000 Mets were kind of an old team, at least as far as their lineup was concerned. So there's not a lot of parallels, I think. Yeah, it's really hard to say. It's hard to draw too many comparisons between the two. They were just constructed in very different ways, and they're kind of very different animals, I would probably say.
Yeah, one of the things that I found really fascinating about the book is, you know, I watch a lot of baseball, and you sort of forget how fast the game changes when you're confronted with looking at how many complete games were tossed for the Mets during those years. From, as you said, you know, somewhat soft tossing guys. We're not talking Nolan Ryan here. We're talking, you know, guys who were mediocre starting pitchers, if not throwing complete games, throwing 7-8 innings regularly, and just how different bullpen usage was, you know, 20 years ago. I was really taken aback by how stark a difference there was, you know, between 99-2000 and today. Even though I knew there was obviously some difference, it really did seem, I mean, shockingly different how that team pitched.
Yeah, just because, you know, the current team, and I think this is probably a baseball-wide kind of thing, but, you know, emphasizing the strikeout, you know, like so many pitchers are, I think, you know, nowadays, like, trying for a strikeout, knowing that players now strike out so much, and there's not as much of the stigma attached to it, I think, if you strike out a ton as there once was. And, you know, the Mets of that era, you know, they're behind Al Leiter, there was like Rick Reed and Bobby Jones who were soft tossing guys. And then they had, in 99, they had Masato Yoshi, who was just kind of a similar type pitcher. They were a little ahead of the curve, though, those 99-2000 Mets were in the sort of their bullpen usage. They did lean on their bullpen a lot, I think a little more than teams of that era did. It had definitely already emerged, you know, bullpen specialization. But the Mets probably of that era did it a little bit more than than their contemporary teams, and a little more like teams do now. Mm-hmm. Because they had a pretty strong bullpen. They had Turk Wendell, Dennis Cook, who's a veteran lefty. And then they had, you know, John Franco, who was their closer forever, and then became a setup guy when Armando Benitez emerged. And so in the regular season, at least, Benitez was almost unhittable for 99 and 2000. It was when they got to October that he became a little more dicey. But yeah, I think that, you know, there were definitely differences, and it was remarked on at the time, like when the Mets finally got a complete game from a pitcher, I think in like late in the 99 season, they hadn't had one in over a year. And it was that was considered unremarkable. Whereas nowadays, I think nowadays, I think, you know, teams go without complete games for months on end and nobody bats an eye. It's just sort of accepted that that's how things are done nowadays. Right. So I think, you know, there was plenty of things where they were, you know, you look at it and they were definitely a product of their times. But I think especially with the bullpen usage, they were almost like a harbinger of things to come.
Yeah. Yeah, I can definitely see that. And I think there's, you know, Edwin Diaz hopefully is not Armando Benitez in a lot of ways. But yeah. I think that there's sort of a similar approach there where, you know, Familia was the closer for a long time. And then you're getting in sort of this younger flamethrower to be the closer. But like I said, hopefully he's not Benitez for a number of reasons. I guess sort of in beginning to wrap up our conversation here, what's your biggest takeaway from the book in terms of how the game has changed since 1999-2000? Is it the aforementioned pitching changes? Is it, you mentioned umpiring has changed a lot since then, just sort of overall approach at the plate. You know, what would you say is the biggest change between players playing in 99 and 2000 and players playing today?
I think it's hard to say what the biggest thing sort of on field is. To me, a lot of what I kept coming back to more and more while writing the book was how much has changed sort of in sort of a media coverage sense, the way the game is kind of covered. I kept coming back to how, you know, back then you had sort of these like mandarins of the New York sports media world would sort of like interpret the game for you. And nowadays you obviously have social media, you have so many other vehicles through which you can like enjoy the game or, you know, share your experience of the game with other people as a fan, and you don't have to sort of like read about it the next day. And so you could kind of sense at that era that people like a Mike Lupica or a Murray Chass or somebody like that seemed to have this like almost like power over how players were perceived. And if, you know, they had beef with you or you clash with them or whatever, they could like set you in their sights and just kind of like, you know, do their best to take you down. There's certainly a lot of people who did that for Bobby Valentine. He basically didn't get along with anybody in the press. And there were a lot of guys who were, because of that, were just never going to go to bat for him. And nowadays I feel like there's a combination of the writers really not being the gatekeepers in the way they once were in terms of how players are perceived, because there's so many different ways for players to interact with fans now, especially on social media. But also there's just sort of trying to think of how to put it, but there's really a you know, there's just sort of again, I'm struggling to express exactly what I was
you don't have to censor yourself if that's part of it. You can say whatever
it's not that. I think I'm drawing a blank on exactly what I wanted to say.
That's okay.
Putting the redacted line over anything, but yeah, I think like it's less, to me, again, it's less how it's played. It's more how the game is consumed, and especially how people interact with, like, almost directly with players in many ways, even though there's so much kind of like media training and that sort of thing. But yeah, I mean, that to me is like the biggest difference, and goes beyond like anything in terms of like how the game's actually played.
Yeah. I mean, the media training is an interesting aspect of it, because you just got the opinion that a lot of ball players were not necessarily prepared from a young age to be in the spotlight. Whereas mm-hmm. today, you know, even players that are brought up through baseball overseas, where media coverage is not nearly what it is here, once they're in the organization, they're getting lessons to be media trained. And so some of the quotes that you see the players saying from 1999 to 2000 would just never happen today. Just never absolutely. In a million years.
You know? Yeah.
And that is really interesting. I hadn't thought about that, but you're absolutely right. That's probably one of the bigger changes that has happened in the game since then. All right, last question before we talk about where folks can get this book. Going back, looking through all of this, what emerged as your favorite memory of these 2 years? What was the bit that you're going to cherish and hold on to forever from these teams?
That's a really good question, because I don't know if it'd be so hard to like pick out one thing. I think maybe one of my favorite games then and still, I think, you know, and maybe if you asked me in a different day, I'd have a different answer. But the one that just popped into my head was a Subway Series game at Shea in 1999, where the Mets won on a walk-off by pinch hitter Matt Franco. If you were around then, you probably remember this game, because it was, even at the time, considered one of the craziest games ever played at Shea Stadium, just including, like, you know, Game 6 and 86 and everything. It was, I think the Yankees hit 6 home runs in the course of the game. And the Mets, every time the Yankees would go ahead, the Mets would come back and tie or go ahead. And there was at one point where Mike Piazza hit a home run that he just completely destroyed, just like clobbered it into the parking lot. And it ended with the Mets loading the bases and then Matt Franco knocking in 2 runs after taking a pitch for a ball that could definitely have been called strike 3, in which the Yankees were yelling at the umpire should have been strike 3. But, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, it's in the eye of the beholder, obviously. But, yeah, that game, which they used to show – they actually used to show that game on Mets Classics on SNY. I haven't seen it on there in a long time. I have a tape of it somewhere in my own archives. But if they ever show that one again on SNY, it's one you have to, like – you definitely have to – sit down and take in the whole thing. Is just absolutely insane just to watch that game. And just, you can't, you know, 20 years on, you can scarcely believe that the Mets won it.
Yeah, that's a great game. I actually saw that game on Mets Classics a few years ago and was blown away by exactly that. It just seemed like there are so many Mets teams of the past 20, 25 years where when they would get down a couple of runs, they just felt like they gave up. Mm-hmm. And you watch this team just come back and come back and come back. And that's actually something I would say maybe is similar to the 2019 Mets, where they seem to have just a much greater fight this year than they had the last couple of years. And there were games early on this season that looked like they should be out of the Mets' reach, and they came back to win, or at least came back to make it, you know, more interesting. And that seemed like a trait of those Bobby Valentine-led teams. Yeah. Well, anyway, where can folks find this book if they want to buy it? I know I was part of the pre-order process for it, but, you know, now that it's out there, where can folks buy the book?
Well, it's basically available wherever books are sold online. You know, you can certainly go to Amazon, you can go to Barnes & Noble, you know, you can go to those websites and order it there. It's available in EPUB form, too, so if you'd rather read it digitally, it's available in that format. I like to tell people to go to indiebound.com just because if you order it there, you can order it through a local bookstore, a smaller bookstore, and then, you know, they get the, you know, they get the cash, as opposed to an enormous place that probably needs your cash less than your small local bookstore does. And then you can, you know, if you want, you can pick it up there, and you know, I just think it's a better route. But
I,
you know,
support that. I've never even heard of that before. But I,
yeah, it's just called IndieBound. Another alternative is the book is published by Inkshares. That's the name of the publisher. You can order directly from them too. But essentially, if you Google "Yells for Ourselves" anywhere, it'll bring up a link for you to buy it and in some format.
Now, before we let you go, do you think that you're ever going to write about the Mets again? Do you think that this is the swan song of your Mets writing career? Where do you see yourself and the Mets converging again, if at all?
I really couldn't say. Writing this book was, I think you called it a labor of love earlier, and it was definitely was that. I think I would probably have to find another Mets-related subject that was that I wanted to work on for several years again if I was going to do that. I would never say never. I have no current plans to write something like this again, but you know, I think it's also wise to, again, never say never.
Are you working on a new book now you can tell us about?
I still do writing, mostly sort of in the fiction vein, do a few nonfiction things here and there. Nothing that's coming out or imminent, just stuff I'm kind of working on for myself at the moment. And, you know, maybe it'll be out there someday and, maybe not, but it's very much, you know, it's all sort of, in a, you know, draft type stage on my laptop.
And where can folks find you online, find your writing, etc.?
If you want to catch me online, I'm on Twitter at @scratchbomb. And I guess if everything writing wise for me comes out in the near future, the distant future, you'll probably hear about it there.
Okay. So that is definitely a place where folks should check you out. You are very entertaining on Twitter. I've been a long time Twitter follower of yours. And I just want to say, you know, thanks for writing this book. This is something the Mets are very bad at, which is celebrating their past. And I don't know if it's the Mets, you know, whether it's them only retiring the numbers of folks who go into the Hall of Fame as Mets, or just their general lack of, until very recently, sort of alumni presence. But it seems like if you weren't telling the story this year, we wouldn't be hearing about this story this year. You know, there's a lot of celebrations happening right now for the 69 Mets, and rightfully so. You know, that is, you know, the defining team of the Mets' entire franchise. But there's been almost no mention made of the 99 Mets so far this season. And for an entire generation of fans, myself included, and you included, you know, this team is the reason that many of us remained Mets fans. And so I wish the team would do more to celebrate their own past. And so thank you for doing it, because we know that they won't.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. And I think you kind of hit the nail on the head. I kind of wrote this book because I had a feeling that nobody else was going to write the book, and certainly that the Mets weren't necessarily going to do anything to honor these teams. I feel like maybe they're turning a little bit of a corner. Seems like they've had a lot of guys, a lot of Mets alums at Citi Field already this year. I think I saw a game earlier this year where actually Turk Wendell was.
Yeah, I saw that game
in
too.
The ground.
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe it feels like maybe they're trying to do a little bit more, and, you know, maybe somebody's nudging them in the right direction. If they are doing that, I certainly hope it, they continue doing that. But yeah, thank you so much for having me on, and I'm glad that, you know, I'm glad that, you know, you enjoyed it, and that people get to check it out.
Yeah, listeners, follow Matt on Twitter, pick up the book, and let's continue this conversation online. Thanks again to Matt Callen for coming on the show. Go to amazingavenue.com where you can find archives of Matt's former work, as well as all of our writing about the current team, as sad as that may be, it's all there at amazingavenue.com. You can find more podcasts, more news, more analysis, everything you could ever want there, as well as on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Amazing Avenue. I'm at Brian Isenap, and we're out of time. We'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.